Welcome to Back to the Sources, a podcast for those looking for a window into the life of Concordia Seminary and our library, whether you are a theologian, pastor, or prospective student. Each episode explores deep theological questions, profound insights, and topics of interest, brought to you by both professors and students alike. We hope that these conversations enrich your faith, academic, and professional development by connecting you to our rich resources. Back to the Sources is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.
Hello and welcome to Back to the Sources. Back to the Sources is a podcast of the Hasse Memorial Library. My name is Kendall Davis. I am currently an STM student in the exegetical department here at Concordia Seminary. Today we are continuing our series with all of our Grapho writers. Grapho is the student journal of Concordia Seminary. I am currently serving as the chairman of the student publication committee. And today we're actually going to be interviewing me. And today I'm going to be interviewed by my good friend, Ben Vanderhyde. Ben, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks for being with us, Kendall.
Yeah, I know. It's good to be here.
So you're an exegetical student, right? Or student in exegetical theology.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Going to be heading out to England.
Yeah, Scotland, University of Edinburgh.
Yeah, right. Those two are different, aren't they? England,
Scotland. They are, yeah. They get mad when you confuse them, especially the Scots.
But here you've written a paper for Grapho on historical theology, which is my area of expertise. So I'm wondering, my area of study at least.
I really wanted to steal your thunder.
So what are you doing writing on historical stuff?
Yeah, this is funny because my fiance, she does historical theology, more Reformation kind of era stuff. And I always tell her like, oh, you know, I do history stuff too. And then I point out like, I like to do patristic. And she's like, no, that's still like almost Bible stuff anyway. Like,
yeah, right. It's just the Bible.
Yeah.
2.0.
And I think I find that I'm interested in the fathers, but I'm especially interested in the father's reading of scripture. So there's a way in which that kind of ties back. I'm also interested in ways that the doctrines that are kind of established in scripture then are picked up by the fathers in their own controversies. And I'm very interested in that interplay. Like, how do we go from, you know, the synoptic gospels, the way they talk about Jesus, to how we're talking about Jesus in Nicaea? I find that very, very interesting. I'm also interested in some of the historiographical questions about how do we tell these stories? Because I understand that there's a way in which the way that we understand our identities as Christians, as Lutherans, as Americans, or whatever, is wrapped up in how we tell stories about the past. But there's also a way in which we think that the stories that we tell about the past are kind of just the way it is. But really, I think that we make a lot of choices in how we tell those stories. And the way that we tell those stories is important and it matters. And I think it's important then to be critical and to think critically about how we go about telling those stories. So that's how I kind of got into this.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that connection between exegesis and the early church, because that all of their theology is exegetical theology.
Like it's crazy.
All their doctrinal theology is how do we interpret the scriptures. As you're talking about telling the story of, Nicaea and and the years following that, where Arianism is just that kind of the main enemy of the church, the Arians are interpreting scripture just as much as the others are. It's kind of a war over how do we interpret these scriptures.
Yeah, you go read Athanasius and you get the sense that this was in some ways first and foremost a fight about how do we interpret scripture. And of course, there's other like theological and philosophical ideas in there too. But as far as like, where is the battleground fought? The battleground is fought on passages of scripture. Yeah.
Cool. So I'm curious, a lot of times we as historians, like traditional historians, will focus on the heroes, Athanasius or Luther, the Cappadocian fathers, you know. But you've chosen to focus this paper on Arius. And I'm curious, What would be your reasoning here?
Well, obviously, because I'm secretly a heretic and an Arian.
Oh.
No, absolutely not.
That explains everything.
I know. So in my paper, I talk about how we do historiography on heretics. And I look especially at Arius as kind of a key test case for this. I think that it's important because I think that there's a way in which our theology is brought together almost just as much by the controversies created by the heretics than it is anything else. I think that it was the challenge of things like Arianism that forced the church to really think about, like, well, what is the relationship between Jesus and his father? And I think you see this in so many other areas. I mean, it's like you see this in the Reformation. Like, it was the controversies developed by late scholasticism that forced the question, like, well, hold on, like, what is the relationship between faith and works and justification and sanctification? And it's these controversies where the church works to clarify what she believes, teaches, and confesses. And so I think that the heretics are important for the role that they play in that. And you can see that just in whenever we tell the story, we always talk about, like, oh, this is what the Arians believed and they're wrong. This is what the Modalists believe and they're wrong. This is how we kind of start to work this stuff out, as we know, like, oh, that was wrong and that was wrong. And that helps us to clarify things. And that's a lot of times how doctrine of the church gets clarified. So I think it's important to understand the heretics' role in that just as much as understanding Athanasius' role in that.
Right. So you're talking about how we tell the story of our past, and that word historiography is an important word for your whole paper. And it sounds like the way we tell the story is important because this is the story of how we got to where we are.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right.
What are you doing in your paper overall? Like, what's the grand scheme, I guess, of your paper?
Yeah. It comes from the observation that it's really easy to treat the heretics as the villains of the story, because in a lot of ways they are the villains of the story. But then we make them cartoon villains. We make, like, their goal is to, you know, take over the church. And it starts to just stop being honest, because we had to remember these were real people. They didn't think they were villains. Nobody wakes up and says, I think I'll be a heretic today. Like, they're trying to be faithful. They failed, and we need to be honest about that. You know, we rightly stand with the church who condemns them and their heresies. But we also need to recognize that they're not cartoon villains. They may be villains, but they're not cartoon villains. And so I think it's important, I use these two words, sympathy and accuracy. So when we tell stories about Arius, etc., we should strive to be accurate. We want to get it right. That sounds, you know, fairly easy. But then I think we should also be sympathetic. And when I say sympathetic, I don't mean, like, try to make them look good. But just recognize that they're human beings just like us, and they're not trying to be heretics. They have concerns. And they may well be legitimate concerns. But to portray the heretics in a way that you can say, okay, I kind of get why they said that. I still get why they're wrong, but I get why someone would do that. I can understand why they would be motivated to say what they said. Even if I still think they're wrong, and I still think it's a heresy, I understand why someone would go that way. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when we tell the stories. And it doesn't have to be, I don't think, you know, this, like, very complex, nuanced, like, understanding of, like, this is how Arius is engaging with Middle Platonism and, you know, the Alexandrian school. Like you don't have to do that. But, like, even when you're giving a basic portrayal of who Arius is and what Arianism is, I think it's important to portray it in a way where you can say, okay, I get why they would want to do that. I think that's helpful. I think that's helpful then, especially for understanding then the Orthodox position, because the Orthodox are responding to this. So if we need to understand what Athanasius is doing, we have to understand what he's responding to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then I think that throws into light kind of some of the dangers of, well, obviously the danger of being inaccurate is kind of goes without saying, is like, are you just telling lies here?
Yeah, who wants to be wrong?
Yeah, but the danger of not being sympathetic maybe is a little less apparent.
Yeah, so, no, it is.
So, I mean, what would that be in your vision?
Yeah, so, I mean, I talk about how I think that if the goal for the church, and that's another kind of part of my proposal, is that I'm not interested in a kind of general, like, objective secularist historiography. That may or may not be something that's worth doing, but I'm interested in historiography done in and for the church, so that this is about the church narrating the church's own story. And we're going to be honest about that. And so I think that it is in the church's interests to be sympathetic in her retelling of heretics in the way that I outlined, because one of the main points of doing historiography of heretics in the first place is so that we can avoid their errors. The reason why the church has identified these people as heretics is to say, don't do that.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the whole point.
Right.
And I think that we do that better if we portray them in a way where you can understand why someone would do that. Because then all of a sudden you see like, oh, I understand why they did that. I understand why someone else would be tempted to do that, or why I might be tempted to do that. I can see that. And then that serves as a much better warning, I think. You know, you can warn people to do things that they think are ridiculous. You know, like, don't be an axe murderer. Well, okay. Like, I wasn't tempted to be an axe murderer.
Yeah.
But to warn someone against something that they could see themselves being tempted to do, that's all of a sudden a lot more valuable. And I think that heresy is subtle. I think that false doctrine is subtle. There's always something about it that makes sense or is appealing in some way. And so when we turn the heretics into cartoon villains, we turn the heresies into cartoons. But false doctrine is so much more subtle than that. And if we want to guard ourselves against it, we have to be savvy in how we tell that story. This is what Jesus says, you know, be as innocent as doves and wise as serpents. And this is part of it. We have to be wise. Wise as serpents and how we go about telling the story so that we can avoid these errors. I think we do that better in our context if we have sympathetic portraits.
It kind of reminds me of, like, in preaching, you're always tempted to point fingers, like, outside the church. And it's, like, it's easy to just pound on homosexuality or abortion, you know, all these things. But then the people in the pews aren't being trained to watch for their blind spots, because like everyone's got those things in their sights, but where's the more subtle sins that sneak up behind you? And you know, those are the things we got to be uncovering.
That's what you got to watch out for. Yeah, I remember watching or listening to a sermon, a church that shall remain nameless. The preacher was, you know, talking about like the evils of abortion, and I was like, yeah, like that's an evil, but also like look at our audience. They're like all like people who are like, youngest age is like 50s, like, and most of it's like 60 plus. Like, that's not really like an immediate like issue for them.
They're probably not lined up to get
their
abortions.
Past that. Yeah. Yeah, that's just not, you know, like where these folks are at. Yeah, so yeah, there's a way in which we need to be careful and targeted, because it's easy. It's easy to go after the big thing that, you know, we know everyone in our community is going to agree about. It's easy to say like, oh, well, Arius hated Jesus. Well... Well, yeah, Arius sounds like that guy sucks. But when you can portray a more sympathetic portrait, then all of a sudden, oh, like, yeah, it's a lot more effective, I think.
And being orthodox isn't as easy as just shouting at the heretics.
It's hard yeah. to be orthodox.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm curious just how you approached this, just, I mean, from a research standpoint, and how the people that you focused on, the particular historiographers that you went to, how did you come to them and how did you distinguish between them?
So I was in a class with Olowski, as most patristics papers, I think, tend to find their origins. and I was really interested in this book by Rowan Williams. Rowan Williams is an Anglican theologian, former Archbishop of Canterbury. And he has this work just called Arius. It's like, you know, Madonna, just like one word. And in it, he has a really like detailed analysis where he talks about a lot of these historiographical issues. And so I was really interested in his work. I wanted to read it and kind of do something with that book. So it was driven primarily by that work. And so then I kind of started to get this idea of doing an analysis of the historiography of Arius. And that ended up taking me in this direction. So then I found other instances, like Greg and Groh is another important one in the field. But a lot of it was just kind of then following the footnote trail, following, you know, kind of what's getting cited in bibliographies, just, you know, searching in the catalog, my keywords, Arius, Athanasius, you know, and seeing what I can find. And I was able to find a good, I think, kind of smattering of stuff to at least get a representative sample, I hope. Yeah.
And what was it about the Williams account? I mean, were you pretty satisfied with his account and like as a historiographer?
Yeah. So what's interesting about what Williams is doing, and he's not the first one to do this, is he's trying to do, I don't know if rehabilitation is quite right, but maybe a reassessment of Arius. Because there is a way in which even in standard patristic scholarship, there is a story that gets told about Arius, you know, that he was just obsessed with philosophy, and, you know, or he was a knuckle dragging literalist or whatever. And you get that, I think, a lot of times in like these survey texts, you know. You get this, you know, book, it'll be like, it'll be covering hundreds of years of early church history. And so like they have to summarize and simplify. And I think that there's been a stream of scholarship, and Williams is just one representative of that, which is trying to kind of take another look at Arius and to reassess, like, well, is that actually what's going on? Because it's tricky with Arius, because we have a couple fragments of some of his writings, but they're all like really short, like it's a couple letters. His one of his main works was called the Thalia, but understandably it didn't get preserved. And we have quotations of it from Athanasius, but is Athanasius quoting him exactly? Is Athanasius maybe like quoting the worst bits? Is he kind of putting a spin on it? Like, we don't know, because we can't go and check. Like, we're used to being able to go and check what someone's opponent is saying, but in this case we just can't. So a big question in Arius scholarship is, how do we understand what Arius actually thought, and what do we make of the information that we have from Athanasius? Because Athanasius is one of our only windows into his thought. But Athanasius is biased, which doesn't mean that Athanasius isn't helpful, but it just means that we have to be careful. It's hard to kind of figure that out. And so that's kind of where Williams fits into it.
That makes sense. I mean, that's quite a picture. How do you reconstruct Arius? It's like, sounds to me like you've got a page of like an Isaiah manuscript or something, and you have like two little fragments like in the corners of the whole, like, this is what the text was, and you've got like two fragments or something, and you're trying to piece together like the rest of it. And so really, like, to give a fair reading of Arius is like, you don't have much to go on.
Imagine like trying to do a history of like a presidential election, but all you have are some articles written by the other side. Like, you know, and so like you'll be able to tell a lot about like that other candidate that you're trying to learn about, but it's really hard because you have to separate, like, okay, like where are they kind of like exaggerating, where are they being selective? And it's not to say like maybe the other side is right, you know, like I think Athanasius is ultimately right about Arius, but it does make it difficult when I just want to kind of understand like what the facts are. Yeah. Yeah, where is Athanasius engaging in description, and where is Athanasius engaging in analysis? I think that might be a good way to put it, and it's not clear. Where is Athanasius saying this is what Arius said verbatim, and where is Athanasius saying this is an implication of what Arius is saying? You know, and this is why Arius is dangerous. That's a hard kind of question to figure out and navigate.
Because he's a human. I mean.
Yeah, you know, Arius's teachings were popular, so Athanasius had to like show them, like, no, like, actually, this is bad, and like this is why. That was the situation that Athanasius was in.
Now the two of them are from the same city,
Alexandria. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and the controversy was initially touched off, our sources indicate, by Arius kind of getting mad at Alexander the bishop, was saying, and then Athanasius was the kind of protege for the bishop of Alexandria, Alexander. And then eventually Athanasius takes over the see, and the fight continues between Athanasius and Arius. And then later, I mean, I would say Athanasius and then all these other people. There's a way in which, as the controversy goes on, Arius fades into the background, and it becomes something much bigger than Arius. Arius was never really the leader of Arianism. There were other people who were kind of more central on kind of what some scholars call the anti-Nicene kind of option. But Arius himself kind of isn't really, even though he kind of started it, he doesn't get to finish it. It kind of moves beyond him a lot.
And he wasn't even a bishop. And then the bigger players are kind of arguing over like his condemnation or his, you know.
Yeah, so which makes it even more difficult, because then like to what degree is Athanasius responding to the ideas of other people and not Arius himself?
Right.
Right. So like, it all gets named after Arius, and that's also like part of the polemics and the rhetoric too. So it gets very complicated very fast, which is why I thought this was a helpful kind of test case.
Right, and teach us historians to plan on doing a bit more legwork when we go back and tell these stories, right?
It's all about the text.
Get into it a bit more, study it. So any last words before I burn your paper? No.
I would just hope kind of that people would kind of come away from reading the essay just realizing that we do need to ask questions about how we tell the story, and that it's not just obvious. It's valid to like do history with an agenda. I think that's fine. I think that might be the only way to do history. But at the same time, we need to be honest about that, and we need to recognize that we are making choices when we tell the story, and to just be responsible in that. Great power comes great responsibility.
Nice. Perfect. All right. Well, thanks for your paper, Kendall, and look forward to reading it in its
final printed form. Yeah.
If you enjoyed Back to the Sources, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Facebook so that you don't miss a single episode. This podcast is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.